Good morning, this is Marlene Tadros. My guest today is Sherif Mansour, who is the coordinator of the Middle East and North Africa program at the Committee to Protect Journalists. He earned a master's degree from Tufts University in Massachusetts, and he has a BA from Al-Azhar University in Cairo. Welcome, Sherif.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Malley.
So this is our second podcast with you. The other one was in Arabic. So I think what you said is really important, and we need to hear it also in English. So how long have you been in the States?
On and off since 2006. When I sought asylum in the United States, had my master's degree in 2007, and applied for citizenship, but stayed in exile in Egypt, from Egypt for 5 years until the uprising in 2011. I went back three times and haven't been back since 2013.
Wow, long time. Let's start with your bio on Twitter, which is very amusing. You have something that says that you are agent provocateur or a provocative agent. Why do you have that? Why do you think you are a provocative agent? I know that you are.
I take it with pride that that's how the national security officers describe me in my security file, which thanks to the uprising against former President Mubarak, we were able to get our hands on a few of the people that describes how far they went to spy on a lot of people, activists inside and outside the country. And I remember one of those files described me also as Quranist, which is the religious sect that my family advocate for. And second was Asian provocateur. And that's for my own kind of activism that I started in Egypt, monitoring the election and training that I've done with Freedom House for young civil society activists and human rights advocates. And later on, when I worked with the Committee to Protect Journalists, to defend journalists who get into trouble, not just in Egypt, but across the Middle East. And in many ways, the description that they wanted was more surveillance from the Gamma Group, a London-based tech company that provided a 3 months trial for them, in which they were able to obtain my Skype conversations with activists monitoring the 2010 corrupt election, the last election Mubarak had a few months before the uprising.
So this is and surveillance software.
Yeah, and that's at the time, ironically, I was telling people that communicating over Skype is safer because it's more difficult for the authorities to break. And they quoted my conversation to them, to their supervisor, to justify buying the full version of the software.
Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about the Quranists? I know that your family come from this type of belief, type of minority to a great extent. What is it and where did that come from?
Sure, I think more than anything, I identify myself as culturally Muslim, but I share a lot of the values that my family and my father have fought for, which pretty much the same values the founding father of the United States had, which is total freedom of religion and total freedom of speech in Islam. And that happens through my dad's interpretation of only relying on Quran, no Middle Age heritage interpretations. And that, of course, breaks all the monopoly of religious institutions in Egypt and across the region on interpretations that allows them to justify violence, to justify discrimination against Copts, Jews, and women. And that's why my dad, while he was in the university teaching and
in Al-Azhar.
In Al-Azhar, seeking to be a professor, his work caused him not just to be fired, but also for the Al-Azhar to formally request that national security arrests him, which they did more than once in 2007. Well, in 2007, he were able to come to the U.S. and all of our family. But it all started in 1987 when they arrested him for the first time and basically kept a case of insulting religion against him to justify arresting him again and again until 2001 when he was able to travel. Right before they arrest him and several others of our family members and people who believe in the same faith. And he was invited by the UN to be honored as an ambassador of peace right after 9/11 because of his role in fighting terrorism. Mm-hmm. And the fact is today, he and I, because we both advocate religious freedom and freedom of the press, stand accused by the government of Al-Sisi of being terrorists, while we all along the way are known to preach peace and to actually imagine a future for everyone in a secular state in the Middle East, where everyone is protected and have their political and civil rights guaranteed.
So to clarify, the Quranists are basically Sunnah deniers, right? This is what they call you in Egypt, which is Sunnah deniers. So you believe in just the Quran and nothing of all its surrounding heritage, right?
There is nothing, there should be nothing between you and God. Mm-hmm. Nothing to, no one to interpret Islam for you. And that's what Islam is all about, according to my dad. And that's the Islam that has a civic, secular state. My dad used to tell us, it's not the job of the government to get you to heaven. As basically as that, there shouldn't be any role. He used to tell us that Al-Azhar shouldn't exist. The state shouldn't have a religion and shouldn't have a religious institution.
Yeah, of course, as you know, I'm quite familiar with your father, and long before I knew you, even a great man, and he has many books. He has authored many, many books, and some of those are what really got him into trouble, Dr. Ahmed Subhi Mansour. Explain to us the circumstances that led to you leaving Egypt.
When I was under threat just by being a member of the family, like a lot of our family members and extended family members who've been threatened, intimidated for more than 30 years. My turn came when I was 17, even before I stepped foot in Al-Azhar University. I was called in for investigation, and I basically was blindfolded, left for hours waiting for someone to come. And they asked me questions like, why don't you pray? And I've stopped praying that at that point for 5 years. And I realize it now. It's right after Farag Fouda, a mutual friend, was murdered. He was basically the reason my father was released after his first arrest, because he wrote an article mocking the police officers who were arresting him for writing enlightened pro-secular books that said, you know, anyone, Jews, Copt, can go to heaven. It's not just Muslims.
Yeah.
And these are the things that I think eventually, after 40 days, allowed my father release in 1987. And for a lot of those 5 years that I stopped praying, I used to tell people, it's none of your business, including my own father. But to hear it from a national security officer,
none of their business.
I couldn't help by telling him, why is this a national security matter?
Right.
And I didn't get a response. Mm-hmm. But eventually, I think they kept, you know, every now and then, every time I go out of the airport, every time we have an election program, they will call in and check in to let me know, including when my older brother, Muhammad, traveled to the United States in 2005. They called me to tell me that they've allowed him to travel. And then I was supposed to travel, and they stopped me from traveling. I was actually going to monitor the Palestinian election that brought Abbas and Hamas to power. And this is when my family basically said, you know, you have to come. There is no way they're going to arrest you this time. And I stayed since 2006 until 2011, when I basically brought back to Egypt 3 weeks after Mubarak was ousted. So this is the kind of history that my family shares, just because they stand by both political and religious reform. It is the same struggle that people have for decades in Egypt advocated for, inside and outside the country.
And you have family members back home who have been harassed and or are being harassed just by virtue of being related to you. And even a cousin who is in prison.
There is at least 27 family members who were forced into exile out of Egypt over the last 20 years, because 15 of them at least were arrested and detained, questioned, some tortured. And it's all about their association with us, the beliefs that we have. And it started to going more for family members after my father and my mother and all of our brothers settled in the US and were granted asylum in 2007. Two of my cousins, two of my uncles were arrested. And some were tortured, in many ways asking them about the relationship with us. One of them right now is still in custody, my cousin Rida Abdurrahman. It's his third time to be arrested. The first time in 2007, they tortured him. In 2015, they threatened him to stop his blog, which he did. But they kept him on travel ban. And then even after having no political or online presence for 5 years, they arrested him again last year in August. And he wasn't alone. There were at least 9 other family members who were arrested that same night, August 21st, 2020. And later on, 3 in September and October, asked to appear in front of the investigator again. And the question, basically, they take their phones, they look through it, they ask about the last time they contacted us, what did we say? They check their Facebook Messenger conversation with us. And in many ways, they just keep those people hostages because they want us to stop speaking up, whether for my dad in his capacity as a religious freedom advocate in the International Quranic Center, or in my capacity as a press freedom advocate of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
So explain to me, since you were here, what is your involvement with the case against the NGOs in Egypt?
Well, this is an involvement that happened early on when my father used to work with the Ibn Khaldun Center. And I used to go there also as a teenager even. I think that's also when I started seeing you, Dr. Marlene, the first time, probably in El Nida El Jadid or El Tanwir, the few pockets of freedom that were allowed under Mubarak era. And for the better end of this century, 20 years now.
You were so young at that time. You were what, 16, 15?
Yeah, and it's never stopped. Yeah. The government tries to defame, smear human rights advocates, right, civil society advocates, and try to pressure them with political prosecutions. And it started against Dr. Saadin Ibrahim, but there was against Hafez Abu Saada. And later on, the case that they bring, even though they say that these people are Asians and CIA actors, it's just about registration paper that they deny. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw Dr. Saadin Ibrahim being released while the court, the cassation court, looked into the case because there was 8 conditionality in the early 2000 that he eventually was released and acquitted of all charges with a very critical verdict that said that, you know, not just said that his work is needed for the society, that Egypt is part of the international community, a signatory of obligations, and they have responsibilities to respect NGOs, the work of NGOs, but criticized security officers for bringing the case and saying that, you know, this was an overreach of the executive body, because they said even judges receive training and receive part of the aid that come from abroad, let alone, you know, the army and the executive body. And this is why when the revolution happened, I think in many ways, the NGOs community were first to be stifled and be taken as targets for revenge for their support of the revolution that came about because of torture and election fraud. The very same things that these, you know, NGOs and human rights advocates have fought against for decades under 30 years of Mubarak. And what we saw from the counter-revolution taking shape through army and security agents and the former regime, starting in 2011, zero journalists behind custodies in Egypt since then. Starting a case, a very broad 173 case, where very broad case that included at least 5 international, 4 US, 1 German, my former employer, Freedom House, 5 of my colleagues on the ground, and 43 in total, people who submitted through the process, according to the law, the requests to the government to register. Mm-hmm. And then they took the requests and accused us in court that we worked without requests for permissions. And accused us in the media that we had weapons in our headquarters and that we were giving money for protesters in Tahrir. And this is, I think, was the overreach that they wanted to do to pressure and cut, you know, the life support that the people around the world had for the revolution in Egypt, so that eventually we arrived to where we are now. Everyone who had seriously tried to work on the transition to keep the government accountable, and the very same issues of overreach of security and press freedom issues have been either jailed, forced to exile, or forced to stay inside the country with travel ban and have some of their personal assets confiscated, even though the government, according to the Court of Cassation and the investigating judge, said that this case does not hold. And to this day, they keep saying there was no need for the case to be brought to court. But these people are still under threat, banned from travel, smeared in the media daily.
But you were here in the States, so what made you go back? And you knew that you were part of this crackdown on NGOs, and you knew the threat of being arrested. Why did you go back?
First of all, because there was hope at the time. This was 2012. And before many of the polarization that eventually led to the 2013 coup. And there was some media freedom that was the only year, according to the count of the Committee to Protect Journalists, where we had. And I was able to not just pressure the Egyptian government, also pressure the U.S. administration at the time to stop their naive approach to the situation. It was called Obama's Cairo hostage crisis, you know, and they basically took all U.S. citizens out and pay a ransom, $5 million, and left the Egyptian there to be put in cages and political motivated trials. And I've had hired five people based on the government recommendation that they said, you know, hire people, show us their names, show us the contract for rent. And I told those people that we're following the law. Mm-hmm. So it was a personal responsibility for me. And the other overreach that I think was also needed to be stopped is that their Egyptian government attempt to extradite me from by requesting that directly from the U.S. Obama administration. And through the Interpol with red notice. They called me fugitive, even though I was never asked to appear in front of any investigation and was never indicted. So I waited in the U.S. until the U.S. government replied, said, this is a political request, this is a political trial, and they denied it, until the Interpol also told the Egyptian authorities that this is a political case, and they denied the request. And I went to Egypt to contest the travel ban against me and appear in front of a judge to formally request it. Which over 3 months, I was able to win my right of travel, but I was released on bail once I appeared in front of a judge. And I'll never forget that June 4th, 2012 day, 2 days after spending, you know, time in custody, they made a point of putting me in chain when I entered the courtroom. And it made me laugh because they have treated me fine all the way. There were, however, dozens of people, many of supporters and family. And when they saw me this way, they erupted in chants, Yaskut, Yaskut, Hukm al-Askar, down, down, military rule. And I never thought of it this way, but I guess like everyone knew what's happening at the time. And that's what I wrote in my foreign policy editorial before I go back. I said, call the generals bluff. And why, you know, what Obama has said in his book last year about, you know, Mubarak and others in the regions being just grifters. He had managed to force him out by having a difficult conversation, but everyone else since have not had that difficult conversation or the follow through needed to even consider Egypt an ally, not a partner. Right now, the fact that they feel that they can take, you know, my family hostages, other US citizen hostages, is because no one is there, you know, confront them with aid conditionality, with sanctions, even as they did with the Saudi government on Khashoggi.
Yes. You wrote an op-ed in The Guardian.
An interview, yeah.
Yeah, and you said that Biden made a U-turn on the policy regarding Egypt. And you also said that he was rather naive and timid. Tell me what the expectation is with the Biden administration.
The expectations are high, and it's not just because he's the Obama second administration, because Biden was there and he described Mubarak during the uprising. He said he's not a dictator. But this time he called Sisi dictator. Okay. And this time he said exactly what needed to happen. No blank checks. That's what everyone said. You know, this is a way to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. I wrote my master thesis on this, aid conditionality. And in many ways, the hope was that he would inherit and even deliver even more if he says that human rights is going to be central in the relationship and that he's going to do a democracy summit. The U-turn in many ways amplify how they fall for the same trap in the relationship with Egypt. Those, you know, generals come here to beg every year for their money, their arms, their toys, and, you know, to bring their children and their grandchildren. And even Sisi himself, he came to the U.S. around the time I was here, you know, handpicked from Mubarak's Ministry of Defense to buy the Pentagon Chief of Staff for a fellowship in Army College. And he wrote his thesis on democracy in the Middle East in 2007. He goes back to become Mubarak's head of military intelligence and to orchestrate and lead the return of the army to control since 2013. So these people, we know who they are. I know that my taxpayer money goes for the same thing that was used against my family and is being used against, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. And this is why the expectations are high. There is, this time, Congress have already asked for conditions, and even the administration have said that they will have their own kind of measures, including Khashoggi sanctions that was employed against the rapid response teams of Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi. And I see no difference between Mohammed bin Salman's rapid response unit and Mahmoud al-Sisi's rapid response units. Mm-hmm. They both take US hostages, they torture people, they disappear people, and they do gross human rights violations, which this administration inherits now, allows people like me to say, you know, you cannot continue because you violate US law by giving your arms, your technology, your support, your material support for the people who do these horrible things to us.
True. But the Biden administration says that they're doing constructive dialogue. And I know that you despise this term, but it's diplomacy. I mean, we never know what's going on behind the scenes, right? Are you expecting something more vocal?
That's what I've been telling them since they took office. And in the beginning, a lot of them were giving the cold shoulder to Sisi.
They were.
In order.
For a while.
And it worked for a while, but not even close. And in many ways, we were told once the administration opened the Egypt file, put everything together, you know, even, you know, about cases like mine, journalists and others, it will be, there will be an opening, releases. And I told them all the time that, you know, it's time to be vocal, to make these requests directly. And more recently, after Blinken went to Egypt for Gaza, it became a complete opposite U-turn.
Right.
And basically the same files that were brought by Mubarak for decades being used again, and naively the administration think that the fact that the Egyptian government is taking care of its borders is a service to the US.
Right, right.
As if like Egypt is not a regional power, not just, you know, a player. In many ways, the naivete is also how timid it is, because we expected for Secretary Blinken, for example, to meet with civil society activists, including speaking publicly when, you know, someone like Hossam Behgat that he met online get interrogated again, opened a new case for a tweet about election fraud.
Yeah.
So giving a blank check on the aid after promising it, all these things shows not just how timid the administration is that they don't have really a vision about how to bring this about. I had given them the benefit of the doubt for months after talking to a lot of people in State Department, even talking to people in Congress. And I think in many ways what we're gonna see happen, that they try to say that they are contemporalizing and they are able to do both. But it's all the same if the Egyptian government still feels that they can do what they do and get away with it. Mm-hmm. And that would be a stain on the Biden administration that will never leave.
That's very true. But you see a difference, any kind of difference in the policy between this administration and the previous administration?
Trump administration was hopeless. I didn't have much expectation
right.
for them. And in many ways, they have done the worst to make things worse, including legitimizing the use of terrorism, false news. And Egypt has become now home to 90% of cases of journalists who are accused and behind bars because of false news charges. It was like music to the ears of Sisi that he used to justify. And in many ways,
Trump mainstreamed it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the Obama administration had a failed response to the Arab Spring, including when, you know, I said, now at the time, Vice President Biden called Mubarak not a dictator. I had been brought to the conversation back then. And I think in many ways, the people in Washington had lived the lie of Egypt is too big to fail.
Right.
And they just didn't know what to do other than having a phone conversation with someone in Egypt to solve everything. That's how they did it. It didn't matter anything else. And they were not ready. And even when I told them how, including to Secretary Clinton, former Secretary Clinton at the time, directly 2 weeks after Mubarak stepped down, restructuring US aid, and instead of giving 1% for civil society and even condition that to the government approval, make a relationship with civil society, with Egyptian people directly, and stand up to the rights. And in many ways, I hoped that the Biden administration will get over the justification that was given later, which is they don't want to wreck the boat too much.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in 2013, 2014, like now the boat has basically sank deeper than the Titanic. And they have seen that happen under their watch. Like, this is a government that continues to this day to get more proportionally aid than any other government after Israel worldwide. And many of that is just on the premise that they play nice. But now they act like North Korea and Iran. No other allies do that other than Saudi and some of those other grifters in the region. But in many ways, you know, if they are going to be considered an ally, to at least call them out when they take US citizens, go after US residents, and apply the sanctions that they said that you would for countries that engage in this behavior. When you have something like the Lahey law, when you have something like the Khashoggi sanction, when you have something like the Magnitsky sanction, I think the only constructive dialogue you could have with al-Sisi is telling them, here is the people that you should be releasing. And if they say, oh, but, and they lecture, they say, and here is the people that will be sanctioned if you don't release them by that day. I don't see why not. This is US law now, and this is the norm after what happened. The only way we can stop something like the Khashoggi murder from happening again.
Okay, as somebody who works with the Committee to Protect Journalists, what, in your view, is the situation of journalists and journalism in Egypt and then in the broader Middle East?
Well, I've stopped kind of my advocacy on freedom of association and political organizing in 2012 when I returned to the US and started working with the Committee to Protect Journalists. And the idea was to keep the fear barrier from being rebuilt. That was the only thing that allowed the dynamo effect we saw happen in the uprising. And the hope was, you know, if those spaces, the online spaces, the exiled spaces remain, we can have a chance against the counter-revolution led by, and since the Arab Spring, closer to 200 journalists dead, making it the deadliest country for the press. Syria followed 140, all since 2011. And Yemen and Libya and Egypt, and but also in the cases of jailing journalists. And I told you Egypt had no journalists behind bar in 2012, but since 2013 have been consistently one of the worst jailers of journalists. And I'm third worldwide with 27 journalists, many of them for nothing other than their role in writing about and defending the Arab Spring and continuing to speak up against military trials and calling for releases. The track record we built also during the Trump years focused on showing how the Trump administration has damaged not only the press locally, which we did, but internationally, Saudi, Emirati, Egyptian officials in the region. So I worked on documenting probably one of the worst toll against journalists the committee have documented since its founding in 1982. In Iraq, since our counting in the Iraq war, unfortunately, in many ways, the Sisi government and Sisi himself was allowed into the White House once Trump won. And he came back to Egypt with an emergency law that has been renewed to date automatically. And with the same politically motivated charges that used to keep people under emergency law in Mubarak under a new name with this pretrial detention. The fact that I think they felt that they would use their supporter in Washington last year, that was one of the reasons they started taking more hostages, arresting more people, and going after families of people who are standing and managed to escape to exile. They felt that their control on the media and on the narrative would be threatened if people like me, people even in Qatar, Turkey, who could speak up, would even have some support from the Biden administration.
So how do you view the future then in Egypt?
I see it as the same future of Saudi and Emirates and even Washington, D.C., even Moscow. I think the rise of authoritarianism that we saw over the last decade was in many ways the response to the Arab Spring that hit home for the U.S., even hit Moscow. And in many ways, a lot of the people who now, the cronies, grifters, are trying to imitate Putin and their vision of the world. And I think when the Biden administration is trying to restore these norms and to say publicly that they want serious consequences, where do you start more than your own allies? People who depend on you for money, for arms, for legitimacy, for solving the dam question, for solving, you know, their, you know. So yes, of course, there is a lot of space. And in my work, I have had to, for 4 years in the Trump years, issue a lot of echoes in the voyage with no one hearing. But the record stays there, including unheard of cases of abuse against prominent leaders, prominent bloggers. And what we're hoping is that while pressuring them, the administration, we're also gonna pressure the European Union, the United Nations, and continue that struggle to keep online spaces and to push against surveillance and against extrajudicial requests like the ones is used freely now by dictators of the world.
Mm-hmm. Sherif Mansour, coordinator of the Middle East and North Africa program at CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Doctor.
Always a pleasure.